Let's get started. So you've got to basically noon.
Okay.
I think supposedly 30 minutes or 5 minutes of questions. So, but,
sure. Okay.
So let's get started. Our next speaker is I'll make sure I pronounce her last name, Danny Bruner, who comes here from Psychogenics. As Danny was telling me at the break, she was one of the first scientists at Psychogenics, and many of us know Psychogenics as a leader really in the field of neurobehavioral phenotyping and a lot of their, I guess what she's going to talk to us about, the various cubes and that behavior and the translational aspects around that. And I'm going to turn it over to Danny at that point. Thank you.
Thank you. So today I want to explain a little bit what we call the cube technology. Some in the audience have actually used the technology as partners with us. So I'm going to show how we are using this cube technology for the next generation projects, which are systems biology. So I hope I can get through this presentation quickly and have some questions at the end. So the problems we have, and some speakers have mentioned, is the translation to the clinic is rather poor, and some of the problems comes from the preclinical studies. I'm going to touch on two issues. One is the false positives in the preclinical realm that lead to bad clinical trials, and also the issue of having robust models in the preclinical realm that we can use to improve translatability. And then I will focus on our proposal to use these high-throughput automated behavioral tests to improve the readouts, the reliability of the behavioral signatures that we find, and also how we can implement the systems for a systems biology approach. We have done drug discovery and phenotyping with these systems for maybe already 10 years that since we started. I'm not going to go there, but you can ask me questions about how to use it for drug discovery in particular. So the issue of false positives, this is one graph that shows you the p-values. So on the x-axis, we have p-values from 0 to very small, and then from 0 to very small as well for beneficial effects and deleterious effects of many drugs that have been used using the R62 mouse of Huntington disorder and the Rotarod test. So these are all studies using the same model in the same test. All these are drugs that have been published, and I will show you the published results later. These are all the results from my lab, where we do the R62 model. We read them, they're always the same way. We handle them the same way. We do Rotarod the same way. And what we find is all these drugs that we tested are non-significant. So anything in between these two bars is non-significant. Very, very few were positive, and very, very few were active but negative. So what happens when we check the same drug, same model, same test in the literature? We see that p-values are mostly positive, significant, beneficial effects for the same drugs. And very few are non-significant, and almost none is negative. So you could say, well, that's just one example, but there are many papers right now, and there are initiatives from NIH. This is a problem. We know this is a problem. It is not just in neuroscience; it's in many other disciplines, and also clinical trials. But if we start with these type of results, it's very sad. But some of these drugs actually went to the clinic for Huntington's disease. So if this is what we base the clinical trials, then it's a real problem. Can we fix it? Well, this is another example. This is sertraline, a very common antidepressant. And this is what I mice using the forcing test. When we do it all the time. Once a month, we have some forcing tests that we do. We always use sertraline as a control to make sure that things work. Sertraline works every single time. There was one batch that was not good from Sigma. We threw it away. We bought new sertraline. All the time it works. And look at the p-values. The results are very robust. If now I look at the forcing test sertraline in the literature, it also works. It's more variable because there are different labs doing it, maybe using different doses, different strains. But when a result is real, it's real, and you can find it. So to have very robust preclinical assessment can really improve things. So that's one of the aspects. The other aspect is working with robust models of a disease. And for this, there are different types of validity that are used. In particular, construct and etiological validity are, for me, the most important ones, because it means that you're looking at processes that are analogous, causes and processes that are analogous from the mouse and between the mouse and the human for a particular disorder. There are other types of validity that help, convergent validity. If you have two very different tests that use very different sensory modalities and they all measure the same process and you find the same effects, great. You got convergent validity and discriminant validity, but anyway, etiological and construct validity, that's what defines a model as being a good model. Unfortunately, people use face validity as something that adds value. And I would say, if you are down to speaking about face validity, it's because you lack the other ones, and that's really bad. So you wouldn't take an orange or a tennis ball as a model of Earth, then you should not use phenomenology to add value to your model. It doesn't. And so these are things that I think have plagued the work in the preclinical realm, and these are things that could be fixed. And I'm going to talk about autism spectrum disorder and Huntington as areas where we were able to find better models that have much more than face validity. So what I want to represent here is a systems biology view of a disease. If we're lucky and we understand what the genetic insult is, it could be a cause, it could be a risk factor, but if we identify it and we can now base the model on the genetic information that we have, then we can track the effects of this genetic insult in molecular cellular changes done all the way down to functional readout, which for me is behavior. The first layers give you etiological and construct validity. The last layer is face validity, which, again, should not matter. But if you have the first two, then hopefully you have at least hope that you have more predictive validity. You can also layer on top of these developmental time, because the genetic insults may lead over time to a deficit. So this is a high view of, you know, what any disease model could be that has a particular identifiable genetic insult. So the idea here is, well, if we could have a very good assessment of these functional readouts, but also we have these omics data that underlie the functional readouts, can we now put them all together? Can we go from gene expression to behavioral differences? And how our technologies could help do that. So I want to show you a couple of examples that really show you how we're doing this. As an example, autism spectrum disorder. This is very varied. There are now a number of genes that have been linked to autism, and there are a number of other models like red, fragile X, and Down syndrome, where there are some symptoms that in common with ASD. There are a number of interesting genes that are now being used to create these models. The models are all, everybody's trying to put them in a C57 background, so now we can compare from model to model. Some models come in different flavors, like we have these three shunk-free knockouts. And what we are doing, we are going to end up with most of these models run through our platforms. So why is this of interest? Well, if we were to do phenotyping with our standard batteries, so every test in here we can run, there are many domains that are important for autism, in particular the social aspect, communication, and repetitive behavior. We could use standard tests to do this, and it will take a long time. The idea is that if we use these automated behavioral systems, then we can capture a behavioral signature that then we can compare across models. For example, if from these models, a bunch of them affect synaptic function, can we now find a common signature across these different models that reflect synaptic function? There may be other models with different genetic insults that have a different pathway and a different functional readout. And we hope that using the system, then we can actually separate the models and find the commonalities just looking at their behavior. So the idea is, again, to build very rich content behavioral data sets and use a bioinformatic approach. And I will explain a little bit how we do that. What we call the cubes is a smart cube, neurocube, and phenocube. Smart cube uses three cameras. You can see the mouse is moving, and you see two side views and one top view. NeuroCube looks, this is a rat, but we have a mouse version, looks at the animal from below and captures very subtle gait features, dynamics and geometrics and coordination between legs, lots of things. And finally, PhenoCube has group mice. We look at the motor behavior, social, circadian, and cognitive behavior. And all these see use computer vision. So the computer looks at the mouse through a camera and makes an automated assessment of behavior. There is no intervention. The only intervention is the human picks up the animal, puts it in a chamber, or injects the animal. And everything else is completely automated. So there is no bias, there is no subjectivity. So what do? With the data? We can look at the data. For example, I can just look at locomotion or social behavior and interpret this as a standard test, or I can take all the data together and use bioinformatics to extract the signature. So when we extract the signature, we can find the signature of a drug, or I can find the signature of a mutation. So in this case, I'm looking for signatures of mutations. Just to explain in a little more detail and give you a closer view, this is PhenoCube. This is a test with two mice. We can go up to eight mice. We can do it running for 1 hour up to 6 days. So the mice we do a 6-day study. The mice are assessed 30 times a second, 24 hours a day, 6 days a week. We get a lot of data, as you can imagine. So in this case, we have two codes working in parallel. One code looks at the behavior of each mouse. Is it reading? Is it moving? Climbing? And the other code that runs in parallel looks at the social behavior of these particular two mice. This is NeuroCube. This is a mouse version. So I don't know if you can see the poles are illuminated in red, so we can get a very nice detailed view of these. We don't need to go back to the video and choose which part of the video has good data. All this is done in an automated way. And finally, SmartCube. This is the oldest of the cubes, and as you can see, we can track where the mouse is, the velocity, the behavior, but also we capture the posture, the shape of the body, the characteristics of the trajectory. We get about 1,400 behavior data points per mouse. So we can run the cubes one at a time, or we can run the three of them and combine the data for a bioinformatics approach. So how do we do this? This is really a very simplified view of bioinformatics. If you have two groups of data and they are floating in hyperspace, why hyperspace? Because if I collect, say, 2,000 data points, then I have many axes. Each of my measures is one of the axes. So this forms hyperspace, which I represent here with three dimensions. So this is a simplification of hyperspace. Very hard to draw hyperspace. So if this in hyperspace, if I could rotate this hyperspace, until now I see these clouds separated, then I have found a way to I have found the features that best discriminate between these two groups. So, and when I say rotate, this is really computer algorithms that are doing this. Nobody's rotating anything, but that's the truth. But in the end, what I get is a graphic representation, a 2D representation of these groups of mice, where these two axes are the axes that are the features of their behavior that best discriminate between the two. I can also take the features, and these are features that going to the right are increased in my mutants or are decreased in my mutants on the left, and we rank them. Because some features contribute a lot to the signature, some features don't contribute. For example, if mice move around with the same velocity, velocity is not going to be a feature that the computer chooses to separate the two groups. So velocity will be at the bottom of my feature list. So when I say top features are the features that are more important to separate the group, the features that are most different between the two groups. So that's my cube 101. And there's a quiz at the end. So these are two models, and these are two models of autism spectrum disorder. And this will be published soon, so until it's published, I can't say more, but these are very interesting two models. What's interesting is that very, very different genetic manipulations. We run them in NeuroCube, they are very different. So the two clouds, they don't overlap. That means they are different. This in here just is a way for us to see whether this was obtained by chance or not. I can explain this more, but basically we calculate in blue what we expect, the distance between the two groups that we expect by chance, and the distance between the two groups when we do this discrimination over and over and over. If what is due to chance and what we see is very different, they don't overlap, then the probability that we found these results by chance is very low. And why we do this? Bioinformatics is a very, very powerful way to analyze data, and you will find differences when there is only noise. And that's an issue that any bioinformatician knows. So this is a way to protect us against false positives. What I found very interesting is that despite these models being very different in the genetic construct that was used to create them, in the gate features that were different between the models, and here's model A, model B, the wild type, and the mutant, what happened? Mutant, this is one feature, this is another feature. The differences in gait were very similar. The top features that created this gait signature were very similar for the two models. When we ran it in SmartCube, one of the models, Model B, was very different. Clouds are very separated. This Model A was not very different. However, to my surprise, when I look at the top features, they were also changed in the same direction. For Model A, the changes were very small, and for Model B, the changes were very high. Now remember, I'm in SmartCube, I'm capturing 1,400 features. The chances that two models will show me the same top features that change in the same direction are quite small. So this, for me, was, you know, it's very encouraging. And what I want to do when we are done screening more of these models, because we are in the process of screening many of these models of ASE, is that if now I have a genetic insult, this is Model A, and Model B has a very different genetic insult, but then I can see the commonalities in the behavioral signature. So then maybe I can go back and identify the pathways that are most important to create this behavioral signature. And we have another example here where we are actually doing this, exactly this. And so let me move now to an example of Huntington disorder, where what we could do is have a genetic insult with a varying dose. How we do this? Well, Huntington disorder is caused by an expansion in the CIG repeat lens in the Huntington gene. And CIG could go from very low. If it goes past 35 in humans, then you already have the disease. If you have 70 CIG repeats, then you have Huntington disease for sure, and it will happen rather early. If you have 90, then you may have Huntington very early when you're adolescent. So there is a dependency on the number of CIG repeats and age. That's very important. So what this project tries to do is to create these different models where the CIG repeat is increased in a controlled way. So we have the CIG repeat series of mutants. These are all different mutants that have different CIG repeats. So in that way, we create an increasing genetic insult. And what we want to know is what is the behavioral signature that is a CAG-dependent behavioral signature. And once we have that, we are also going to have all this omics data, gene expression, proteomics, to understand the underlying pathway. So the idea is that if we can see that the CAG signature is composed of several behaviors, and those behaviors correlate with some omics data that underlies them, then maybe what we can do, we can clean this up. Now we have the behavioral signature and the underlying pathway. We can also see other pathways that are changed but have no functional consequence, and we can also discard them. So anything that is acting on this pathway and it fixes something, some aggregation or some molecular or cellular signature, but has no functional effect, then it should be discarded. Why go to the clinic with that? It may fix something, but if it doesn't change functional readouts, who cares? So if we can come out with this picture where we have discarded most of the pathways and we go from behavioral signature to molecular signature, then now we are in a very good place to do new target discovery, but also to understand how we can actually fix that pathway. And actually, this is the CAG signature. So the first question is, can we capture a CAG signature just looking at the behavior? So let me explain this a little more. So what we're doing here, before I explain a little bit, when we have two classes and we train an algorithm to separate these two classes using bioinformatics. Here we have more. We have a group that has of mice 20 CAG repeats, 80, 92, 11, 140, and 175. So we have six different lines of mutants. And what we want to do is train an algorithm to find what's common, what is changing the behavior of these mice that is dependent on CAG signature. And I'm showing you these results from the 10 months of age. We also did the same for 6 months of age, and we did the same for 2 months of age. As expected, 2 months of age did not show much of a signature, but at the older ages, there was a clear signature. So what we see in here, these are results where what we did is we trained the algorithm using these five lines, 80, 90, 111, 175. We train the algorithm with that, and then we show the algorithm the data corresponding to the CAG20 mutant and ask the computer, what is the CAG repeat for this animal? And the answer was, it's about between 20 and 60. It's a low CAG repeat. So here what you see, these are the subjects simply ordered, and in the y-axis you have CAG. So if the prediction had been exact, it will be that the blue and the red will be one on top of each other. When we train the model, then we ask the model what is this, because the model has already seen this data, the answer is exact. The model knows exactly what the data is. When we train the model without a particular line, then this is the true test of the model. The answer, the problem is a lot more difficult. If we now train the model with the highest CAGs and the 20, but now we leave out the 80 CAG repeat and we ask the model what is this, it classifies the mice correctly with some variability. Then we do it at 92, it also understands this is a higher CAG repeat than the others, it 111, 140, 175. So what I'm showing here is that if I get a mouse from my colony and pass it through the cube and ask the computer will know with some degree of certainty what is the CAG of this particular mutant that has never seen just based on their behavior. So this was the first requirement to then go ahead and add the omics data to this and do what I showed before, which is find which are the pathways that underline these changes that that can be identified and then used for target discovery and drug discovery. So basically this is my last slide. The data was from CHDI with their permission. We have a number of partners that that work with us using the cubes and using the standard tests. And the cubes were started with NIH funding, so we are very grateful for NIMH and NINDS, which funded SmartCube, PhenoCube, and NeuroCube, and lots of people involved in the production of this data. So if you have any questions, happy to answer.
We got about a few questions. Well, the system of growth is very intriguing. It also put emphasis on having correlations between the different levels. What I noticed from some Huntington rodent model work, that we couldn't always, we would find behavior profiles in the absence of, you know, that model changes. But I'm wondering what your experience is with those mice strains, to what extent do you find these correlations, or if not, what your hypothesis is that you may be looking for the right hypothesis?
With the knocking animals, I think that the pathological changes do correlate with the behavior quite well. We work a lot with the Q175 mice, and about 6 months of age, then you start seeing differences at all levels. As I show, if you go earlier, 2 months, then you don't have a signature, no matter what the CAG repeat is, and you don't see the much change in the pathology. If you do see some changes at the molecular cellular level early on without behavioral readout, then I will say that those are maybe the beginning, but they are not somehow the animal can compensate for those early changes. And then the changes seem to be larger to be reflected on at the behavioral level. I'm a behavioral scientist, so if there is no behavioral change, I think it's not important, but other people think otherwise.
Well, you mentioned the rotor-rote, and we noticed that already at 2 months, it's a better phenotype, and there's not really pathology there. So we test also 2 month cohort. Do you find the rotor-rote?
Well, with the back animal, every model comes with its own problems. So with the back animal, because there is an overexpression of Huntington protein, normal plus mutant, then you also have changes in body weight. We have shown that if you control for body weight, part of that deficit goes away. And in the open field, the hypoactivity also goes away. So you have to look at the model, the other things coming when you insert the construct. Have you also disrupted another gene? Did you leave a construct there that you didn't want to, a new cassette? I mean, I'm not a molecular biologist, but. I went to many conferences. I was listening to Dr. Lansbury talk this morning, and I heard many times that mice are not needed, behavior is not needed, and I heard this most in the Alzheimer's realm. I don't know why, but I believe that the mice are very useful, and that you can learn a lot from the mice. That, in particular, this it came late 2011. But if somebody has done this experiment early on, then maybe some clinical trials will have avoided. And I can say that at least in one case for minocycline, I think we help the mouse help. Stop some clinical trial that could have been a bad thing, because we found the mouse, the mutant, but not the wild type, was sensitive to the toxic effects of minocycline. So in my mind, going to the mouse and looking at the behavior for both beneficial and deleterious effects is very important.
One more question there.
I'm not a pain person, so I know that that's a very difficult area, because there's a lot of very good analgesics preclinical that, at least for some type of chronic pain, maybe that you don't have efficacy. So I'm more on the neurodegeneration and CNS area, I know more about that. On the pain area, I know there is a problem, but I don't know what's the solution.
Noceptive versus inflammatory. I think inflammatory pain, if you have the inflammation aspects, I think translate very well, even though we know there's major differences in the immune system, but I think looking at pain as pain becomes...
And
That one I can't.
There was a strong condensation. Again, the pain is not my area. I mean, I hope that the better models of pain can be built. Obviously, there is some lack of translatability that needs to be addressed, but I don't know enough to say what's missing there.
All right, let's thank you.